Mr. Damodaran has agreed to take questions and answers and any thoughts you might want to share with him, so please feel free. Daniel will come around with the microphone because we record these meetings so that our co-workers in World Goodwill who live all over the place can listen to them. So put up your hand and he'll come around. You can record.
I guess I might as well start.
Thank you.
You made a distinction and you talked about how the difference between leadership and representation, and you think that the UN in some capacity may have to play both in the coming years. My question is, do you think there is some danger, because I can already see sometimes certain reluctance people have in even wanting to consider the UN or to find out about it. They don't necessarily know all the good work, so to speak, that some of the different organizations within the UN do. Would it be better if there is a reference to certain offices or to specific parts of the UN, like the Security Council, and then speak of the UN as this, in another way, in a less specific way, as this, as you say, this stage that is offered for all these nations, for we the people, mm-hmm. to tackle this crisis.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think you've got two elements there which I would like to respond to. The first is really, in a sense, the absence of information which sometimes leads to mistrust about the United Nations. And in fact, before we began, Sarah was telling me how when she was growing up in rural Wisconsin, I think, at her school, which had just a room without too many desks and chairs, there was a United Nations flag right there. And you had the sense of belonging at that time. And further in our conversation, I think the one point that came across was that one of the reasons why there's been this certain disinterest, if you will, in the United Nations, particularly in this country, is because it's seen as not too involved. And that really goes to the heart of what you're saying, that people do get involved when it's a tangible cause with which they think, which is, and I think, I mean, I don't know how many of you last night saw UNICEF or the U.S. Committee for UNICEF boxes for trick-or-treat on Halloween. You know, that's been very much a part of the American individual philanthropic culture, if you will. But again, the second element to that, I would say, is that it's important to address the fact that any country in the world is immune to what the United Nations can doing or what it should do, or should be averse to the leadership that the United Nations can provide at an intellectual level, particularly, in other words, giving ideas of what can be done. Just last week, we had a major UN report called The State of the World Cities, which was released, which showed that, I think, 40% of the African Americans in this country have a lower life expectancy than nationals of China or some states in India. And if you look at New York State, in Western New York, the number of people that about 8 years ago in African-American, Hispanic, and ethnically mixed households who were earning less than $15,000 a year was 35%, while the white households was about 15%. So you have you have those disparities in cities and in what one would expect to be traditionally advanced communities in the United States as well. So there is no us and them in this equation. I fully take your point that leadership has to be on specific issues. And when I was saying that the United Nations should be a stage and actor, I think it will have to be. Any notion of the United Nations being a world government or a world leader as well as a world assembly is, to my mind, and I think to the minds of all its member states, not only dangerous, but frankly, completely impractical. So there's reassurance in that. I mean, it's a danger which will never come to pass. But I think just as many of us have been moved by great works of literature, great works of spiritual wisdom, great religions, these have been forces in our life offering leadership to our own lives, which was the last L I tried to elaborate upon. So too the United Nations must be, in a sense, that leader which offers the possibility of transformation to its own constituents. That is where the stage and the actor comes in. But it can only offer it, it cannot compel it, it cannot enforce it. I have, as I said, a subtext that I feel that the peoples of the world will ultimately compel their governments to accept what is just and reasonable and necessary. But that is not part of the equation. That's an additional personal thought. Thank you.
Presentation.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
I have a question that's not completely formulated, so I'm just going to try to formulate it. But I was struck both by your story about the women in the well and the acronyms. And one of the concerns I think maybe I have and other people sometimes have with the UN are I'm wondering, how do we put together both the need for bureaucratic organization, and at the same time, we all know that bureaucratic organization often lacks dynamism. It lacks that personal part that we all treasure about life. I mean, the idea of a fully organized, perfectly, you know, bureaucratic world sounds awful to me at some level. And yet we know we have to have this kind of organization. So I guess part of my question is, how do we do this and then retain this dynamic life part that we all value and that makes living fun, that spontaneity, something that comes that isn't from a committee with an acronym?
Absolutely.
So that contradiction, right. How can we think about that? That's my question.
Frankly, the situation now actually is a little more reversed, frankly, because you find that many committees which were earlier seen as very bureaucratic and very institutional have now become overwhelmingly non-bureaucratic, to the extent that there's sometimes a danger I'll say this quite openly, sometimes a danger of non-functionality. What is happening is that virtually every committee in the United Nations, including, or every body in the United Nations, including the Security Council, is opening up its deliberations to the world outside, to civil society representatives, to field workers, to come and talk to them. And that means that while you have much more, and this goes back to the acronym I try to suggest, while you have much more openness, you have a welter of good and stimulating ideas, you have invigorating conversation, but at the end of the day, you do need some semblance of whatever you call it, organization or bureaucracy or structure, to be able to take these ideas and put them forward. But I fully take your point that that bureaucracy must have, and I would like to embrace that particular word that you used, it must have spontaneity. And which is why when I, at the very beginning, when I talked about my New York subway experience, I said it was really what I think prepared people to be indulgent towards me or warm towards me was because of the spontaneity of the way I went to them. It was not something which was rehearsed or prepared, and their own reactions, they didn't have time to prepare and rehearse them. And we have to be, I mean, if there had been an S in the word goodwill, I would have probably used spontaneity as the other element of the acronym. We must be much more limber and nimble and be able to react. And by spontaneity, I'm not necessarily only only meaning alacrity. It's not only speed. It's being able to be intuitive, if you will, being able to deal with issues as they come up with imagination. I'll give you one instance, if I may, of how we've been able to reconcile a necessary bureaucracy with the compelling need for quick response and spontaneity. As a result of technological changes in communication, in seafaring, in a whole host of areas, today, if there is a ship carrying relief supplies for the World Food Program, which is sailing in the Indian Ocean, let's say towards Madagascar, it can change its course and go towards Aden within a space of 45 minutes. So there you have the best of both worlds. You have the structure which enables the ship to be loaded and assembled and deployed in the first place, the structure that enables the alert to come from Aden saying that there's a graver crisis there than there is in Madagascar, and the ability to be spontaneous and react at 3 o'clock in the morning when this happens. But that's just one example, and the whole point of an example is that it's obviously not representative of the whole story. And I fully agree with you, Kimberly, that we must take that and make it part of the whole story, or in a sense emblematic of the whole story.
Thank you. I thank you so much for the opportunity to hear you. And when I got the invitation a few months ago about this, and I look forward to it, one of the first things I did was go to the United Nations website. And I found it very difficult to figure out how does one volunteer. I mean, we all come from different backgrounds. I went to one site that I felt totally inadequate in terms of what they were asking for. I don't know many languages. I mean, I have, my specific background and what I can offer. If there is some shortcut to how does an ordinary person like myself, offer time and volunteer time to the United Nations. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have a program. It's an institutional program called the UN Volunteers. I don't know if you went to their site. But that's really much more global. In other words, it's for volunteers who are prepared to go anywhere in the world, not volunteers specifically within their immediate communities. That's certainly one site I would suggest that you look to. And if there's any problem in finding it, please do email me personally, and I'll make sure that your email, its headquarters are in Bonn in Germany, but I can make sure that they get there and they can be in touch with you about possibilities at that level. Having said that, the United Nations is not a very it's not a very good organization. Possibly it's too bureaucratic an organization to really have too many volunteers in its for itself. I mean, we do have, the one thing all of us have, for instance, are interns or people who come in and work for a few months, as most large organizations do. I would suggest that any creative volunteering opportunities would really come from the non-governmental organizations or agencies which support the United Nations. Because then, in a sense, you're really doing something for the United Nations, but in a much more tangible and, if I may say so, in a much more satisfying manner, rather than dealing with this fairly anonymous bureaucracy where the needs for volunteers at particular geographical locations like New York or Geneva and Vienna are fairly limited, while there is a need out in the field. So that you could get through UN volunteers, but equally you could get working in the metropolis of New York with a non-governmental organization like Oxfam or Save the Children or even many of the smaller ones. And that, I think, would be the way to go.
Thank you. Your talk was very thought-provoking, and I'm still at the point of putting fragments of thoughts together. I guess my question relates to this crisis of democracy being an opportunity for the democracy to manifest within the UN itself. At the point, if you look at the different crises we have, it's interesting to me that we've always had world hunger, and it was something that the UN has always addressed as a manifestation of brotherly love, but it didn't necessarily affect us all. And we've always had crises, but those crises never affected all of us. And now we live in a time where of global warming, it affects us all. And we live in a time of the world hunger. But then we live now in a economic financial crisis that started in the United States, and the threads and the ripples of which are being felt all over the world. And now no matter what country we live in, we're all hearkened to the fact that we're so interdependent. And we're looking now for solution. It's interesting to me that it comes down to money. But then I see the UN as in a position for the first time, perhaps, and ask a question, that it's in a position of manifesting a world democracy by saying we are in an international financial crisis. This is not just a crisis that the United States can now solve. And now we're going to perhaps, maybe it's at the UN level that we start looking at financial architecture mm-hmm. and saying now we're going to start making that more equal. And then, I don't want the question to be too long, but then in doing so, the UN might actually be in the position, because of those new archetypes that they come up with, be able to solve the other crises, the world hunger and the global warming.
No, thank you. I think there are three elements which are important, which I'd like to briefly address. The first is on the global financial crisis. Obviously, the centrality of its relevance to the UN is not only because the crisis is global, but because it calls into question the very structure of the United Nations multilateral financial system, if you will, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the United Nations itself. And the General Assembly is in session right now, and the President of the General Assembly called a special meeting earlier this week, and they have appointed a high-level panel to come up with ideas which could include possible suggestions for restructuring the international financial system as far as what we call the Bretton Woods institutions are concerned. It's a committee headed by the Nobel Prize winning economist Joe Stiglitz. So you have again that openness in a sense of having creative academic ideas coming into the political arena, and that brings us to the leadership role that the United Nations takes the lead. But it cannot enforce those ideas. Those ideas are for the actors that the member states have to then take on for themselves and decide how far to go. The second element really is a question, I think, of and you began by referring to a crisis of democracy, and I think it was sustained because one of the things to my mind, and I'm very glad that you brought this up, one of the greatest perils to democracy is the alternative which is offered by proponents of an authoritarian state, that you will not have situations like a food crisis or famine because everything will be tightly controlled. And that was the entire rationale of Stalinism or Soviet Russia, and I dare say possibly even to a large extent Europe between the wars. So the true crisis of democracy that crisis is certainly going to be fueled if we do not prove that solutions are possible within a democratic framework, and that those solutions are not necessarily exclusively local or national, but are global solutions which will have a national impact. And I'm very glad that you brought in that element. The third, I think, is in a sense a more philosophic question, if you will, about the fact that there is, that each of these crises is an affront to human values, I think, or a sense of the innate human person, that you realize that this is, that a crisis somewhere is an affront to your dignity as an individual in New York. And I think that is obviously resonates with the theme that I'd suggested for this talk. And more important than that, I think it really, and it goes beyond the cliche of an interdependent world or a globalized world. I think it really comes through in very, very practical manifestations. And so far, I think, for instance, the only primary commodity in the world which has really had a cartel controlling it is oil because of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. But the moment you're able to create similar cartels or similar groups to primary commodities that affluent nations like the United States or Western Europe, or for that matter, increasingly India, were to need, you will have a situation where it no longer becomes a part of enlightened moral self-interest, but also becomes an issue of eminently practical self-interest. And that, I think, is what the United Nations should do its best to help avert.
I wanted to thank you very much for this very enlightening presentation. I personally learned a lot about the United Nations. Most of us in this room understand intellectually or philosophically the need for the United Nations, but I've been educated as far as the practical achievements and accomplishments. And I think in a way, the United Nations may suffer from the need for public relations to some degree, because most of us hear the United Nations peacekeeping force going into a foreign country. Well, we don't really see the relevance of it in our day-to-day lives. And if we could, I think it would be such a benefit if we could have someone like you or some organization where people go out and speak to groups and just talk about how relevant the little things. For instance, I think you were talking about the council, mm-hmm. Human Rights Council, mm-hmm. where people, individuals, groups have a right to challenge. I didn't know that. I don't know how many people know that. So I really think that it would be a great benefit if something like that could take place.
I'm most grateful. I know that one of my very distinguished predecessors several years ago went to a fairly hostile audience and began by saying, why is it that there's so little information about the United Nations? Is it ignorance or apathy? And one person answered, I don't know and I don't care. So you do have a situation like that, which unfortunately is very prevalent. But I think, and this is really the point that you've honed in on, if I may say so, it's become so much part of our lives. And this is what we were talking about a little earlier when we were talking about even curriculum in schools. Even if schools don't want to teach about the United Nations, they're compelled to bring in the United Nations if they talk about virtually any issue. So since this is the last question, I'll just end a thing with an illustration of what I mean. I mean, I think all of you have at some point or the other traveled on an airplane. The moment you get onto an airplane, when you're flying, the fact that you're flying, say, from New York to Lisbon, the fact that the pilot always communicates to ground control in English is because of the International Civil Aviation Organization, a UN body, which has set that as a standard language. The fact that the flight path is cleared because of atmospheric conditions is because of the World Meteorological Organization, a UN body which alerts aircrafts on how to fly. The fact that when you actually land at the airport, you have a radar sensing system which guides it down is because of the United Nations Space Agency based in Vienna. While you're on the aircraft, if you're, to go back to my acronym, if you're daring and are prepared to eat the food, you will find that the food on the aircraft is, by statute, protected by a joint mechanism by two UN agencies, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Health Organization, under a system called Codex, so that you have food which has to be certified as being fit for human consumption in an airborne space across several hours. If you see a movie on the flight, you are seeing a movie which enjoys protection because of the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is a UN body. When you land at the particular place you're going to, like Portugal, if you are going to go and see a site of touristic importance, you have the United Nations World Tourism Organization, which works with that government to make it hospitable to tourists. And again, you have UNESCO, the United Nations Educational and Scientific and Cultural Organization, which protects many of these historic monuments. So I'm just giving you that one example to show how commonplace events in our lives, it's almost like when you see this computer saying Intel inside. I mean, I think there's no experience any of us can have which does not have that label United Nations inside. We're there everywhere, and that's probably why we do inspire a lot of the mistrust or fear, or as our very first question suggested, apprehension. Are they overstretching themselves? Are they going to do too much? Will they intrude into our private space? My answer is no, because there is no private and public any longer in this partnership. Thank you.
Thank you so much for an absolutely wonderful talk. Really, it was just wonderful. And I think we all feel so inspired and more knowledgeable than we were when we came here about the United Nations and its work on behalf of human rights. Our work this afternoon is not done, but as many of you know, we do work with meditation in all of our gatherings, because that's a means of mobilizing the energies that are generated through talks like Mr. Damodaran has given and the group discussion that we've just had. We may not realize it, but we are working with mental energy, and now is our opportunity to focus it and distribute it through group meditation. Following our meditation, we'll have a tea and coffee break, and I am asked to remind all of you that our work today, as all of our work, is funded entirely by voluntary donations. We don't charge for our meetings, but they definitely do have costs, and we would appreciate any contributions you can make. There are baskets all over the place just waiting. And let's see, we have a book table with books by Alice Bailey as well as some other authors, and there's a special focus on books of hers that focus on world problems and issues like we're discussing today. We have lots of literature which is available for the taking, no charge. I guess I've run through all my little spiel. So now we will have a meditation. A few words. Dale will be leading it. What we do, if you have not been to our meetings, is a type of Raja Yoga, which is the kingly science of the mind. We don't work with the meditation of emptying out the mind or meditation for relaxation, but with a form of meditation that mobilizes and directs mental energies. So as you look at the meditation that you've been given in your packets, you'll see that the theme of it is strengthening the hands of the new group of world servers. Our meditation is a service. It's meant to be a group service. And our objective, to strengthen the hands of all the world workers, not only in the United Nations system, but in all fields of human activity, financial, educational, cultural, religious, scientific, where there are good people working for world betterment. We begin with group fusion, coming together as a group on the mental plane, as, in a sense, one mind. Then using our visualization powers, we envision our alignment with our group here, with our fellow co-workers and members of the new group of world servers throughout the world, which form a kind of network in consciousness, not on the physical plane. And then we envision that line of lighted energy linking to what are called the spiritual hierarchy, the masters of the wisdom, the kingdom of souls, if you will, and extending beyond that to the Christ at the heart of hierarchy. Here we are not referring to the Master Jesus, but to the world teacher, Christos, being from the Greek, the Anointed One, the same entity as the Messiah from the Hebrew word, the Anointed One, the Kalki avatar expected by the Hindus, Maitreya awaited by the Buddhists. This is the world teacher. And beyond that to Shambhala, the center where the will of God is known, a center not on the physical plane, but a center in consciousness. We work with a seed thought to develop and expand our understanding of it. And the seed thought is through the impression and expression of certain great ideas, such as human rights, democracy, humanity.